From the campus of Maharshi University of Management, this is World Radio, KHOE 90.5 FM, and you are listening to the program, A Chat with the Dean, with your host, Dean Dr. Kathy Guarini. Welcome, Dr. Guarini. The studio today has quite a celestial glow. Who did you bring with you today?
We're very happy to have with us today Dr. Peter Swan and Susie Swan. Peter is the Minister of Communication of the Global Country of World Peace, and Susie is the mother of the Ministry of Communication. They have come here to Fairfield to teach a course on Maharshi Vedic agriculture. The course is being taught right now. And Peter, could you tell us about what is being taught in this course, and are the students enjoying it?
Thank you, Kathy. It's really a great joy to be here. The last time I was here was in with the Taste of Utopia Assembly, 1983-84, and not much has changed, I must say. It's all cold and snowy, just as it was then. But the course is going very, very well. It's the first 16-lesson course on Maharshi Vedic Organic Agriculture, and we go deep into the principles that Maharshi laid out based on his beautiful angle that agriculture, he plays on the world on the word agriculture, agreeing with the culturing intelligence of natural law. So we go deep into how nature works, how natural law functions, and we see how the plants get their food and how the from the soil, that is, and how they work with the soil microorganisms to get the food, and the soil microorganisms provide the food to the plants willingly as a byproduct of their own activities. And we go into many, many different aspects of agriculture, showing that in every area of agriculture and gardening, easier, simpler, non-destructive, more productive methods have been developed in all parts of the world that allow farmers and gardeners to do less and accomplish much more, and at the same time to improve the soil and the whole environment. So it's very, very thrilling, and all this is on the basis of the fundamental level of agreeing with the culturing intelligence, and that is the field of consciousness through the practice of transcending and enlivening that total natural law, all the beautiful qualities of natural law in the transcendental field, that is all the qualities of Ved and Vedic literature, particularly with the TM City program. So these are the fundamental ideas that we are throwing around on the course, and it's been great to be with the students and with a number of faculty who are there. I think we're all enjoying it.
So if someone were to adopt Maharshi Vedic Organic Agriculture, what is it that they would do differently than someone just farming?
Good. Someone just farming, in this part of the world, they'd be farming corn and soybeans using Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup to kill off the weeds. Not so? So the first step would be to go organic. And that would mean that they'd have to stop using any synthetic chemicals, anything that is damaging, anything that's toxic, and they would have to adopt systems, as I've just been describing, that actually nourish the soil and don't deplete the soil, as has been done worldwide. Worldwide, about 94% of the world's soils are degraded. 40% of them seriously degraded. And what we see is that the methods are there in regular agriculture to completely transform that. Even in less than a year, in many cases, they can repair the soils. So Maharshi gave us the angle that for Vedic organic agriculture, modern research, modern scientific research on organic agriculture, and profound Vedic technologies are the guiding light. So the two together. Just like in Vastu Vidya. We use modern scientific research to guide us through the maze of what materials to use and to avoid electrosmog and so on. And in Maharshi Ayurveda, we use modern systems, also modern methods and approaches. So in Vedic organic agriculture, we use the modern and we use the ancient. So the first step is to get off all the toxic stuff, get organic, and then the next step is to, and this is not yet available, the Vedic pandits, the recitation of the Vedic pandits, which is Maharshi's key gift in terms of Vedic organic agriculture. The Vedic pandits recite specific shlokas, specific aspects of the Vedic literature, at certain specific times in the growth of the plants. There are eight stages in the growth of the plant. For example, the seed, in the first stage it swells, absorbs water and sprouts. And then the next stage is the sprout starts to spread in the space, in the air, and then it spreads out and achieves its full spread, and then it flowers, and then it fruits, and then it goes to seed again. There are actually eight stages. And these eight stages have to occur fully and completely for the plant to be completely healthy and completely nourishing to be eaten by us. So the Vedic pandits offer their specific dharma, their beautiful duty that they have to be able to recite those specific aspects of natural of Veda and Vedic literature at those eight stages to ensure that the transformation from stage to stage takes place completely and fully.
And when will that aspect of the technology be available?
That, we hope, by the end of this year. Dr. John Conhouse is working on that, particularly with Sarah, and we hope that that will be available by the end of the year.
And so I have a number of questions here. You know, I have heard that this you know, chemical way of farming is efficient and cost-effective. Would this Vedic organic agriculture cost more to produce food?
I think in many cases it will organic agriculture costs the same or less. What is difficult is all the paperwork that has to be done and the checking and the certification. This is a lot of work. It should be the opposite. It should be that someone using poisonous chemicals should keep the record and be checked. But because of the nature of the time we live in, so the organic farmer has to do that. It's kind of upside down. But the techniques that I've been telling you, I can give you an example. Farmers in Germany, they have standards. How many times the farmer is expected to pass over the field? It's all regulated, and they have to pass over the field eight times to produce a wheat crop or a barley crop. Okay, eight times is the standard in Germany. Now, there are farmers who we're in touch with, and all over the world, there are one or two farmers who are doing it with one pass over the field organically. There is no erosion, and if I can explain it, I think you'll get it even without pictures. In the autumn, in the fall, they sow a crop of rye and perhaps hairy vetch, which gets established in the autumn, and then it lasts through the winter quietly. It doesn't grow, and then in spring it erupts and covers the field, grows up, and then they roll that flat on the ground and make a mulch out of it. It's a sacrificial crop. Now, that into that mulch they sow the next crop of wheat or beans or cabbages or corn or whatever it is. That rolled crop, it acts as a mulch which conserves all the moisture in the field. They didn't plow the field, so it, all its aeration, and all its structure is intact to conserve the moisture, and it also acts as food for the earthworms and there's microorganisms in the soil, and it prevents any weeds from coming up. A few weeds get through the mulch, but not many. So when the farmer has rolled and sown his crop, which he can do in one pass,
and that is done before the vetch and the rye have produced seeds?
Yes, just before, actually just after. They produce the seed, and when the seed is still milky, it's not yet mature, so it's not viable, but the energy of the plant has gone into making the seed. Then they roll it, and then it won't come up again. And then the farmer he has a roller on the front of the tractor and a direct seeder on the back of the tractor. So in one pass, he's done the whole job and he can go on holiday. And the other man is struggling with rain and erosion and fertilizer and chemicals and fungicide and cultivating weeds. You see the difference?
Yes.
Now, this is what is available for all crops have been tested like this with similar methods. Much less work, much less pollution, and beautiful, rich, healthy crops and improving soil every year.
And it must be healthier for the farmer as well.
Much healthier and less stressful, but it requires more alertness and it requires more intelligence on the part of the farmer. He's not just a technician doing what the agent said and so many kilos of this and so many. He's got to watch the crop carefully, and he's got to strike at the right time and work with nature.
Beautiful. And the Vedic technologies that could even be available this year, how would they work? Would you hire some pundits to come for your whole planting season and your growing season, or would they
something
travel
like
around?
That. Something,
or?
Yeah, whatever is possible in the beginning, and later on we should have groups of pundits who are residing there, because any farmer who is not just doing monocropping, just corn and beans, he's going to have many crops coming up throughout the year all the time, yeah? And they can be doing yagyas for local people at other times in the winter, for example. Yeah.
Now, will this work also? We have a dairy farmer here in town who's he's just the joy of the town with his rich, abundant milk. Yeah. It will work for him too?
I think so. And we've been going deeply into farming with cattle as well, with cows, and showing how we're going to visit Francis in a couple of days. We're looking forward to that tremendously. We've been enjoying the delicious, rich milk. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely
from
wonderful.
From Radiance Dairy.
Yeah, it's Radiance Dairy. And it's a real treat for us. And so we're looking forward to that. But yes, there are many breakthroughs there. One of them is, and I don't know if Francis is using this, that they found that the sugar content of the grass is much higher in the afternoon. And so if you limit the grazing of the cattle in the morning and put them on in the afternoon, they get a lot more from the grazing. And some farmers have increased their milk production by about, I think it's 5 gallons. Is it a gallon or a... Or
gallon. We have gallons here in this country.
Cow, right?
Per day?
So something, five something. I don't know if it's pints or
something.
Gallons or something, yes.
We but have pints, gallons,
but very quarts. Significantly they've increased just by that little breakthrough. Mm. So there are many different things, that are coming out, and it's very, very inspiring and encouraging to see every day almost there are significant research results coming out in different fields of agriculture that are showing that it's completely possible to create a sustainable world And by more production in agriculture, not less production, and with no toxins at all.
Now, how did you get interested in agriculture?
Susie and I were born in Southern Africa, and both of us on farms, uh-huh. and our fathers were farmers. And as a child, I saw that all the farmers didn't really know what they were doing. They were shooting in the dark, they were trying this, they were trying that, there was more and more erosion, there was more and more problems, disease and so on, and it was unsatisfactory, and I always wanted to understand how the whole thing worked. And then when I started to work, Maharshi brought us to Flodrup, to Meru, in 1999. And then I started to work. Actually, I'd been working on agriculture before under Maharshi in Southern Africa, but then we were working more intensively, and so then we went deeply into it. I remember once we were explaining to Maharshi that in one country where they had dry summers, we had to plow the field, and it was difficult. And then we had to harrow the field, and then sow the crop, and then roll to get good contact with the seed, with the soil. And then he said, no, 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 no. He said, what is agriculture? It's just sowing the seed and watching it grow. And I thought, wow, you know, this is... And now, just a few years later, it's possible to do exactly that.
Amazing, amazing. Now, Susie, your aspect of agriculture is gardening, and I understand that Vedic science has been influencing gardening now.
So the garden is, of course, at its basis, Ved. Soil is an expression of the unified field, and the plants are that finer expression on the surface of the soil. And the plants, in a way, are the governors of the entire situation, as Peter beautifully explains in his course. And the basis of gardening and garden design has very much to do with the growing medium, which is the soil, of course. And soil is a very generous, broad term for anything from 100% compost to just sand. And the way we almost consider the soil to be something very sacred, to be treated with great respect and sensitivity, and that it is in fact a bank that you invest in. And it's not just what you're putting into the soil, it's what you are enlivening as the soil's own self-sufficient agents to make it function. Soil existed long before we did and was managing just fine. We don't want to get into the problems that have occurred, you know, particularly since the Green Revolution with soil management. But the main thing is that I have had it's been incredibly fulfilling for me to work closely with Peter on the agriculture side, and now to expand it into gardens, and now again into garden design. And a year and a half ago, we formed, together with Dr. Ike Hartman, a Vedic Garden Design Institute, which fell, you know, slightly to the side of the umbrella of Fortune Creating Homes, because Maharshi had been fairly firm that Stapatyaved or Vastu was just the design of the houses and not the gardens. So that's why we created a separate institute. And what we offer is a structural design based on Vedic proportions to incorporate anything from just a decorative garden to an edible garden. And often nowadays we're noticing people would like a combination. They want their vegetable or fruit or berry gardens or herb gardens to be very beautiful. And so now it's a cross-pollination of all aspects of beauty and functionality and nourishment. So it's nourishing visually, nourishing at those deeper, more Vedic levels, and nourishing in terms of what you eat. Yes.
Now, the Vedic design, does that have to do with where plants are placed or what plants you use?
Yes.
Or, and how they're grown?
Well, actually, essentially, it is just the structure and the proportions. And the individual person or client informs us what they would like in the garden and if they would like us to guide them where would be more auspicious to put a tulsi plant or a lily or a fruit-bearing plant. We can guide them. And we can even get completely involved with the individual plant placement. But essentially, the base level is the structural form or proportion. There is another...
Proportion, yes. Of what?
Yes, good word.
I mean,
good
point. I have a very limited garden that doesn't seem to have any proportion of anything.
Right. So your vastu, which is the fence surrounding your house, has a certain size and proportion, and the fence has a certain distance from the front and the side and the back of the house. And within those parameters, features with formal edge can be incorporated. There could be a fountain with four little corners, or it can be a mandala garden. It can be a corner garden. It can be even a little waterfall garden. So the
within the vastu fence.
Within the vastu fence. Mm-hmm. And we have also done a separate garden adjacent to the vastu, which has its own vastu fence and its own ideal
very
entry
nice.
Point and its own Brahmasthan. But these are not strict rules that have to apply. These are simply to reflect, honor, and enhance the same vastu principles that are used in the house that you live in. There is a more refined value of garden design that's also been brought out by Mother Divine, and Maharshi Ji worked with them on that. And that has to do very much with not so much the species of plant, but the color of the plant. And that relates to the cosmic counterparts. And it would change from time to time according to the astrology of that time.
Mm.
So that's another very much more refined value that can be taken up.
Do you also take into account companion planting? Here on campus, we have a garden club, and it often comes up what grows well with tomatoes, mm-hmm. how does a basil do with flowers, and all this kind of thing.
We certainly do take that into consideration. And again, it depends on how much the client wants to get involved in that. It's just optional. But it's been an area of informal study for Peter, definitely, very much. He's my mentor in that area. And we've gone into it quite deeply and read many books. But sometimes people themselves are quite well read and well versed in these. So that's not our base level. It's not our primary platform. But certainly we can offer that if people are interested. You know, some people have absolutely no interest in herbal plants and only want pretty flowers. And others, and we're glad to hear this, would like herbs incorporated mm-hmm. and even a few edibles, because we know that the herbal plants are like kshatriyas, little warriors, protecting and balancing and acting as medicine men and medicine ladies, should I say, medicine devis, and in the garden, and they really do something about making that garden well protected. And I only, when I think of what experience a cow has in the field that it's put in, if they ever even get into the field. And Peter has spoken and I think, on the course quite a lot, and of course it's been a topic of our private conversation, the importance of the variety of plants available to the cow, and how it's a kind of an immune system on the field. And if you can see the cow as a continuum with its environment, it's not separate. It's almost like a mistake of the intellect to think of the cow as a separate object that you can just throw medicine in and shake the tail and hope it's all fine. but it's a one continuum. We are, the cow is, the field is, the plants are. The whole thing's synergistically intelligent. And there's a subject called hormesis, and I think it would be very nice to ask Peter to say something about that.
Can I ask you to,
yes,
what we're just talking about, will there be a publication coming out?
Potentially.
This would be very interesting for people, especially our gardening club,
yes,
here on campus.
I mean, there's certainly many books in the world now. There's such an awakening and such a sensitivity growing that people are tapping into the Vedic knowledge and Vedic principles. You know, it's happening. Yes.
So you're listening to KHOE World Radio 90.5 FM. This is Kathy Guarini with a chat with the Dean. And today we have Peter Swan and Susie Swan with us. Peter is the Minister of Communications of the Global Country of World Peace, and Susie is the mother of the Ministry of Communication. And we've actually been talking about agriculture because Peter is here teaching an agriculture, Maharshi Vedic Organic Agriculture course. And we have just been talking about gardens, and this topic of homesis has come up, and I don't think I've ever heard that word. Could you explain that to us, Peter?
Yes, thank you. I first heard about it from Dr. Rainer Picher, the Minister of Health of the Global Country of World Peace. Homesis is a principle like homeopathy, where a very small amount of a stressful or toxic substance introduced into a system can stimulate that system. And we see that operating. I think what Susie was talking about is, if you let cows into a fresh pasture, they won't just go and eat the grass. Many of them will head straight for the edges of the pasture where they can reach the herbs and windbreak just across the fence, and they will browse and eat the herbs that they need in order to balance whatever they need to balance. So, yeah, so this principle of homesis, and some people say that the reason why vegetarian diet is so healthy for people is that every vegetable has some toxic value to it. And that minute toxic value keeps our digestion, brain cells, everything on its toes.
So when you say toxic, you don't mean some chemical fertilizer. You mean some naturally occurring substance in the plant that would be considered toxic.
Exactly. Also from the angle of Ayurveda, there's almost no food that is only good for you. Every food has got something that's not good for you, but it's a small amount, so it still rates as food. The balance is on the plus side, you see, on the good for you side. So that little bit of negativity, it keeps your immune system and everything on its toes, keeps the system purifying and agile, alert.
And it detoxes it. It acts as a kind of
helps
a,
to, yeah.
It can act as a stimulant to,
yeah,
slightly detox, and boost the immune system at the same time.
But it wouldn't work to just say, oh well, I need a little bit of toxins. let me have some
arsenic.
Arsenic or whatever. but in the context of the plant, it has a small amount, and it's balanced by... I mean, this is a totally new idea to me, and it almost sounds scary.
I think if we could take the emphasis off toxin,
yeah,
onto the reality, which is, in fact, that that the plants are medicinal, and they have detoxing agents in them, and they have things good for the liver and the kidneys and the eyes, and they're actually almost like natural antibiotics. And if the plant is given a mono diet, what would you say, mono plant diet?
The cow.
Yeah,
the person.
Cow, the person, even. Yeah. Then the immune system and the digestive system may be a little sluggish. And then there's a need to introduce a chemical antidote, as opposed to that natural balancing with all maybe 40 different little herbs naturally occurring in the field.
This sounds very similar to the idea that here in Iowa, I know there are some organic farmers starting up in pastures and in fields that have been, the usual way of farming. But they're finding that the weeds in the field turn out that they're growing there because the soil needs those weeds. Is that right, Peter?
Yes. Yeah. Certain weeds specialize under certain conditions. For example, where the soil has been compacted by excessive plowing and there's a plow pan there, then you'll find thistles and dock growing there because they have a very powerful root system that can break apart. And they don't grow well where there isn't a compacted level in the, like a plow pan in the soil.
So thistles are really our friends.
Everything is part of the whole. Everything is doing its bit to heal and take the system on and evolve. Only we don't realize that. And in this whole... Yeah, you want to say?
This is fascinating.
Yes. And in this picture.
It's such an exciting topic. Continue, because I can hold it.
No, I mean, I've always thought of thistles as like sort of...
Bad guys.
When they're not my friend, they're an imposition, and I have a new attitude toward them.
You see, they're not your friend because the house that you live in was built by somebody who observed the law in the U.S., and that is that when you build a house, you have to compact the garden area. So the whole garden is compacted. The soil is compacted. So, of course, you've got... That's their job, is to uncompact the soil. So the thistles are growing in your garden. But as soon as the soil is uncompacted, they'll fade away, and you can do things, of course, to improve the soil much more quickly and bring in the earthworms and maybe with a fork loosen the soil a little bit and use a lot of compost, and then you'll restore the soil food web. And restoring that, it's the soil food web, it's the microorganisms and the larger organisms in the soil that create the structure in the soil, okay, including the plants. So they create the structure, and it was only because it got smashed by the construction equipment that had to compact it that it's not doing very well. And so you restore it, and in this whole process, the plants are in charge. Mm-hmm. The way it works is that the plants do photosynthesis, they take sunlight, and they stitch that sunlight and the air together with minute quantities of minerals from the soil. The plants, the dry weight of the plant is about 97% sunlight and carbon dioxide and hydrogen from the air. So it's air and sunlight. Only 2 or 3% is from the soil. Where do they get that from? They get it from the soil organisms, microorganisms, from the bacteria and the fungi living in the soil around their roots. They feed the microorganisms with the carbohydrates that they produce through photosynthesis. They push it out through their roots. They push out, grasses put out maybe 25% of their total carbohydrate production, they put it out through their roots. Why? Apple trees put out maybe 80%, 70% of what they produce goes out through their roots into the soil. Pine trees, evergreens, up to 90%, 95% of their total production goes out through their roots. Now, why should this be? Is this a big mistake, an enormous mistake? No. It is because they are feeding those microorganisms around their roots, which getting this carbohydrate and a bit of protein and so on from the plant provides to the plant the minerals that it needs. Okay?
And because they're just a tiny little organism surrounded by the soil, they can take out these minerals atom by atom.
They are specialized in that. Uh-huh. Yes, they are specialized in that. But it's the plant that is in charge of this whole process of give and take, and give and take. And right now, today is the 12th of February. So in 12th of March, some of the plants will be starting to show some spring bud. Mm-hmm. And it's at this time of the year, about 4 weeks before the first spring budding, that the trees start to push out the first carbohydrates into the soil to wake up the soil food web to start providing the minerals that those plants need to create the spring burst. Right now, at this time of the year, in the middle of winter.
That is amazing. Now, I understand in this course we can get a lot more knowledge about this. How can people find out about taking this Maharshi Vedic Organic Agriculture course? And how can people find out more about the Vedic garden design?
Well, during lunch today, one of the pioneers on the Invincible America Assembly came to me and said, could we run the course for the Invincible America Assembly? I said, I'd love to do that, because this is a course for lovers of Maharshi's knowledge. Mm. It's deep in Maharshi's Vedic science. So we'd love to do that. We'll see if there's a way of organizing that. And for Susie, to contact Susie for Vedic garden design.
It would be ideal to contact me directly through the email address is very simple. It's just vedicgarden@maharishi.net. And then I'll be able to see what your need is and refer you to the department that would help you with that design. There's also a website for the cosmic counterpart color design. That's to do with the plants and the colors, not the structure and the proportions. And that is www.maharshivedicgardens.com. And just to step back one little point to offer one last comment, yeah, which is dear to my heart, and that is this unfortunate term for these great heroes of the plant kingdom, people refer to as weeds. And you look at, they're out there rescuing us. They're what they call pioneer plants, or the scar tissue of the world. When there's building sites and or earthworks or road building, you see an abundance of these vigorous plants that put any average garden plant to shame, because you're not trying to make them grow. They're just doing it so well on their own. And these, it's so interesting that the planet offers us these plants, which are so nourishing, high in protein, high in vitamins and minerals, and very many of the traditional cultures of the world pick these plants and use them as a basis for their nourishment. And now it's with the age of ignorance starting to dissolve its hold a little, and people are becoming more aware. These plants have now, there are new gourmet trends coming in, and the restaurants are offering different kinds of wild basil and rocket and what we call
amaranth,
the seed and the leaf, which is, I was brought up in Zambia as a child, and that was very much a staple for us, a delicious spinach, very nourishing. And the Chenopodium album, which has many different names.
Goosefoot or pigweed.
Yes. And you only need a handful in the soup, and you've given yourself a treat, given your body a treat. So for me, these are just, again, flags letting us know that there's a terrific trend right through the consciousness of the globe. an alertness and an awareness and an appreciation of these base levels.
I think what you're saying is I was in France for 3 years, and I noticed that the plight of lawns were always dandelions. Yes. But they used them. They would go out and pick them for their salads. And
yes.
It's probably the same idea.
Mm. Exactly.
And what can one do with thistles?
they're edible.
Thistle tea.
What part of them?
Well, there's a certain kind of thistle that is quite the wild one. That's really spiky.
That's what I have.
You can pick that little flower, and it can be cooked, and the inside is just like an artichoke. and they are medicinal, the roots.
But the thing is that those thistles are telling you something. They're telling you that your soil is not healthy. Mm. And so what you need to do is add compost and restore the soil microbe populations, and then they will take the ground cover, whatever the plants are on the surface, to the next stage in the plant succession. You see? It's stuck at that first stage of weeds because the soil food web is not progressing. It's still compacted.
So just pulling out the thistles isn't going to help anything.
No, grow a good crop of thistles 1 year. Or what one farmer is doing, at least one farmer, he is growing what he calls tillage radishes, right? And tillage radishes are Japanese radishes, you know, these long white ones. And he grows them in the autumn, in the fall. He sows them just before the fall. They grow up nice and big, and they break open the soil. They go down 2-3 feet. Breaking open the soil, then with the first hard frost, they're killed. They're eaten during the under the snow during the winter by the soil microbes, and you have a beautiful aerated lawn in the spring.
Beautiful. But if one sees it in context, as Peter said, that thistle is just a messenger. It doesn't mean to say you can't take it out and have the soil decompactified and turn it into a conventional. Pretty garden.
Right, well, we'll see how that turns out. Now, I also hear there's some really exciting development with the Maharshi Channel. You know, most people here in Fairfield know you, Peter, as the voice of the Maharshi Channel.
Yes, there is. Thank you, Kathy. But can I just say something
before we
move on? I just wanted to say that the aim, you could say, of this course and of Maharshi Vedic Organic Agriculture is to make a contribution to invincible nations, peaceful world. And one beautiful way of doing this is to use it to turn every peace palace and school and capital of ours into a model of sustainability, using all these systems to create really sustainable communities. And so I'm looking forward to working with the students here and the faculty to take this forward in some way if possible. I know you're doing so much in this area, but some other ideas may have come out on this course that will help us to move that forward and to train people who will be able to take the knowledge out more. So that's the
beautiful,
one thing.
Beautiful.
Yes, it's such an excellent. Because Maharshi wanted to have garden cities, right? Vastu garden cities. They will be the incubators of invincibility for the whole nation. And those garden cities, Maharshi always spoke of in terms of food self-sufficiency. They should have their gardens and their orchards and their cows and everything. So this is what we are interested in promoting. Yes. So, Maharshi Channel, thank you for asking about that. Dr. Steve Glickman in Holland has been working, and he has secured funding to make the Maharshi Channel available on iPhones and iPads and iTouch. And it is now available. The beta stream will be free of charge for the next 2 to 4 weeks. After which we'll begin to charge a subscription fee. How much that will be, I'm not sure yet. Some people are for a higher one, others for a lower one. We'll see what comes out. But we invite everybody's comments about the stream. Please email them to satellite@mahashi.net, satellite@mahashi.net. And if you want to receive the stream during this beta phase, you can go to Safari on your mobile device. This is, of course, only on Mac because it's iPod and iPhone. iPad and iPhone. So you go to Safari and enter www.mahashichannel.in /mobile. Put that in the address bar, mahashichannel.in/mobile in the address bar, and use the username mobile, M-O-B-I-L-E, and the password MCM2011, MCM, Mahashi College of Management, 2011. And now, touch the graphic to watch the stream. So, this is now available, so you can watch the Mahashi channel on your iPhone. But we want to say that we strongly encourage all mobile phone users not to use a mobile phone held against the head during a phone call. Use the speakerphone or an AirTube headset instead. And furthermore, when using Wi-Fi in your home, please locate the Wi-Fi transmitter as far away from your living space as possible and turn it off when you're not using it, such as when meditating or sleeping, because this has bad effect on the whole system. So it's a great new step, and we thank Dr. Steve Glickman for this.
That is really, really exciting in this mobile age.
Yes.
And you say iPad is available for iPad now?
iPad, iPhone, and iTouch.
Very good.
Yes.
And not only is Susie involved in the Vedic garden design, she's also working to help the pundits in India. And I understand you've been developing quite a bit of support for the pundits.
Yes, Susie is the international coordinator with a couple of her friends to set up the national coordinators in every country to raise funds in their country for the Vedic pundits.
Uh-huh.
Susie?
So this is a great concept, and it's taking off beautifully. And so I'm, as Peter said, I'm working together with Mona Kegi, mother of Domain of Invincible Switzerland, and Colleen Rosania, who I believe will be well known to many people here. And we three are a formidable team. And so what it's based on, and the principle that Peter had, the idea that we should model it on the very, very successful approach that was used in Great Britain by Peter and Babette Ledbetter. And the idea, in essence, is that everyone wants to feel they can do something to support the Mahashi Vedic pundits in the Brahmastan of India, because we know that was nearest and dearest to Mahashi's heart. That's the core project from which all the other expanded projects, Mahashi Vedic projects, will come from that. And of course we know that here, and we feel it, not only know it, here in beautiful Vedic City, you have your Mahashi Vedic pundits. So I think you would all appreciate why it's so important for us to get it happening in all parts of the world, and of course most importantly in the Brahmastan of India. So the principle is that anybody can contribute some small amount per month. So there's no strain, just exactly within the range of comfort, some small donation. They can sponsor an eighth of a pundit or a quarter of a pundit or a whole pundit or a group of pundits, and they can donate online on the website www.mahashivedicpundits.org. I think everybody's familiar with that website, or we have other methods that would suit the individual's needs. And what we have done is we have appointed in all of the countries that so far are participating a national coordinator, and we have now, and we're working very closely with Raja Harris and Eileen Kaplan on this, and have their very, very delighted support and appreciation of this. So we have now given these national coordinators a title of ambassador for whatever country, for example, Thailand, for the Brahmananda Saraswati Fund. So these ambassadors are working very actively in their countries now, and we now have 32 countries participating and 40 ambassadors functioning in those roles. And we have a target that hopefully by the end of the year we can have 8,000 Vedic pundits supported. For example, if we have 30,000 people all contributing, each contributing $60 per month, we'll have our 8,000 pundits in place. So, and these sponsorships are specifically and individually for each pundit's living cost, their cost per month, which is approximately $240. And we have a contact address in case you wanted to ask about that. So it's NC Vedic Pundits, so N for national, C for coordination, Vedic Pundits, all one word, at maharishi.net.
And how many pundits are being supported now this way?
We're now on about 1,400 pundits, the fully settled now.
1,400. That's amazing.
In the Brahmastan.
In the Brahmastan. Yeah, and yeah. And now there are some there are training units now building up for the next level. And we've just had another prime country this morning join this program. And their little group, we had a conference call together with their Raja and Raja Harris, and on the spot that group put down committed donations, monthly donations to support more Vedic pundits. Mm-hmm.
This is amazing.
This is a grassroots approach to support the great work of Dr. Howard and Mickey Settle, mm-hmm. and the big donors who are able to have that joy. But we can all participate in our small way. Mm-hmm. And if everybody participates in a little way, then we can have this great support that Susie was mentioning. Yeah?
That is amazing. So how is this grassroots approach of supporting the pundits, how is that fitting into the total picture?
So what it is that we have our treasured large donors like Howard and Mickey Settle and other great people supporting at that critical level with their very generous donations. And what this is just at, as Peter says, at the grassroots level, this is the regular, perpetual, every month, small, regular donors. And that's like, if you can imagine a pyramid, it's that base level that is very secure and ongoing and permanent. And as people notice, which they do notice, that they experience personal benefits as soon as they're supporting the pundits. And the more they notice that benefit coming to them, then certain people are able to donate more and they graduate up the pyramid. But there's never any pressure and it's always very comfortable. And they are very treasured to us. Every single drop in the ocean mm-hmm. of consciousness is a treasure.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory today. This has just been completely fascinating. We've had Dr. Peter Swan, Minister of Communication of the Global Country of World Peace, and Susie Swan, Mother of the Ministry of Communication. And we have covered Vedic organic agriculture, Vedic garden design, weeds. We've talked a lot about weeds. We've talked about the Maharshi Channel and support for pundits in India. And thank you very, very much for coming to Fairfield to be with us. And thank you for talking to us on the radio.
And please come again.
And please, please, please come again.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you so much for your great help in bringing us here. We feel very honored to be here, really honored, and we treasure the opportunity to come here. And if it's possible to come again, we'd love to come again and support in any way we can.
And it's our great joy that our 16-year-old daughter has come to be at school here at MSAE. And she is so happy. The transformation in her, it's deeply fulfilling for us.
Yeah.
So that's certainly going to be a magnet to bring us here again and again.
Yeah.
And so this is certainly the fullness of fullness, our hearts, her hearts, everyone's hearts.
Mm.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
Jai Guru
Dev.
You have been listening to the program, A Chat with the Dean, here on World Radio KHOE 90.5 FM, with a special interview with Dr. Peter Swan, Minister of Communications for Maharshi's Global Country of World Peace, and Dr. Susie Swan. Thank you for listening, and until next time, Jai Guru Dev.